Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. And our first item of business today is to talk about drought and monsoon. Did you know that while part of the Midwest is in drought right now, in fact, the northernmost counties in Illinois, where I am, really could use a lot more rain than we've had so far. Well, you probably aren't aware of the fact that arid southwest of the U.S. is an area which does get a monsoon, and it does get rain during the year. Colloquially, the term monsoon may be used to define any heavy downpour of rain, but in fact, it refers to a seasonal change in wind direction and circulation. And this is with respect to land masses and nearby large bodies of water. And most notable is, of course, the monsoon of India and Southeast Asia. However, monsoon circulations occur in Africa and in North America as well. And here in North America, in the southwestern part of our continent, the monsoon season of the southwestern United States typically runs from July into September. And though this circulation is less extensive and is of shorter duration than the monsoon of Southeast Asia, thunderstorms that result produce flash floods, vivid lightning, hail, and damaging winds. If you have friends who are retirees living in Arizona or in New Mexico, they've probably told you about this. The benefits include the arrival of rain in an otherwise arid environment and subsequent reduction of wildfire risk. And that's ultimately what I wanted to get to in this first item. But let's take this step by step. First of all, there is what we call a thermally induced or sun-induced semi-permanent surface low pressure area that forms over the Mojave Desert. You know, the Mojave Desert is in California. It's in the interior of Southern California. And then secondly, there is a surface and an upper level high pressure system that forms over the Rockies or the high plains in the interior. And third, in response to these seasonal circulations, low-level moisture is drawn off the Gulf of Mexico and off of the Eastern Pacific. Moist air, which is moving from those water bodies, is heated by the land, and then as it's being lifted by the mountainous areas here in the interior, it begins to cool and to condense, and then thunderstorms form. The very active pattern over the southwest of thunderstorms has aided in reducing fire risk this year. The center of wildfire concentration has, as a result, shifted across the Pacific Northwest, the Northern Rockies, and into Canada. And if you look at a map of the wildfire distribution currently, there are none in Arizona, New Mexico, some along the Nevada-California border, and a couple in Colorado. And then the rest of them are in California, in Oregon, and Idaho, and Washington, and on up into Montana, and then into Canada. The hazy skies that we've been having in this area here, in the Chicago extended area, in northeastern Illinois, is in part a result of the wildfires in Canada and the jet stream, which is whooshing down from that area and has captured the smoke from the wildfires there and in Idaho and northeastern Washington. So I thought I'd start off today with a little bit of climatology and continue with it by talking about a heat dome. You may have heard that expression if you watch your TV weather person talking about the heat dome that has formed over the western states and created such extremely high temperatures in recent times. Well, much of the western U.S. is enduring a punishing and an unforgiving summer of heat and drought and wildfires. Hundreds of heat records have been shattered, and drought encompasses at the present time a whopping 94% of the western states. Wildfires have scorched nearly 4,000 square miles. You might say, well, that doesn't sound like a lot. Well, it's an area larger than the states of Delaware and Rhode Island put together. The people who are living out in the West have been in this cauldron of misery, and it has been made worse by a sprawling heat dome that has wandered around the West this summer, sending temperatures skyrocketing. A heat dome occurs when the atmosphere traps hot air like a lid or a cap. A heat dome is the result of a strong change in ocean temperatures from west to east in the tropical Pacific Ocean during the preceding winter, according to the National Ocean Service. The warm air coming from the west part of the Pacific Ocean gets trapped in the jet stream as it approaches land. And when that hot air arrives overland, the atmosphere traps it. Winds move the heat dome around, and hence it is also referred to as a heat wave. Nearly 60 million people in the West are at the moment enduring a drought, all the way from Washington to New Mexico. And nearly 95% of this region is in a drought, the highest percentage in at least the past 20 years, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. Extreme record-breaking heat leading up to last week has resulted in the rapid deterioration in drought conditions that have existed across the North Pacific Northwest, the northern part of the Great Basin area, which would be in Nevada, for example, and the Northern Rockies. In Oregon, where drought has intensified and expanded from severe conditions to exceptional levels, soil moisture, stream flow, and the standardization precipitation evapotranspiration index, that's quite a mouthful, isn't it, is a drought monitoring indicator that includes the effects of precipitation and temperature. And it shows precipitation and temperature conditions are among the driest we've ever had, going back to 1895. The state of Montana, for example, has recorded less than 25% of its normal precipitation in June, which is historically its highest precipitation month. And impacts there included infestations of grasshoppers. The hot, dry air underneath the heat dome that was created has created a tinderbox of conditions that are conducive to the spread of wildfires. A large dome of high pressure will continue to bring extreme heat across the Northern Rockies and across the Northern Plains into this week. And then, along with the above average temperatures, the combination of extreme drought, gusty winds, and lightning from thunderstorms could make conditions ripe throughout the West for wildfires to form and to spread uncontrollably. The heat dome can thrust temperatures 10 to 20 degrees above average. In some places, Montana, Idaho, and North Dakota may reach triple digits this week. Extreme conditions like what the West is enduring this summer are often from a combination of unusual, random, short-term, and natural weather patterns, which are heightened by long-term human-caused climate change. Scientists have long warned that the weather will get wilder as the world warms. Climate change has made the West much warmer and much drier in the past 30 years. Special calculations will be needed to determine how much global warming is to blame, if at all, for a single extreme weather event such as this summer's extreme heat. Did you know that today, home is where the work is? For centuries, the morning cry has been, off to work we go. The workplace was at a distance, physically and mentally, from our homes. But the pandemic left a good portion of workers, maybe 42% of Americans, by one estimate, doing their jobs from their homes. Those who don't are largely essential workers whose work demands that they leave home behind each day. In some ways, society has returned to the days before the 18th century Industrial Revolution, when working from home was the norm. And then both men and women might make brooms or shoes or weave cloth in their homes, often with materials supplied by an employer. When these home workers turned in the finished product, They were paid not by the hour, but for each piece completed. A forerunner of today's gig economy. People had control over when and how and just how long they worked each day. Parents were able to juggle childcare and earn a living as needed. In the United States, in fact, one set of data suggests that it wasn't until 1914 that most people were employed outside the home. Working away from home brought advantages to employees as well as employers. Workers joined together with others to form labor unions that boosted wages and improved their working conditions. Peering into 2021, it's unclear when or if millions of people will return to offices. Some businesses have set goals to bring back workers. Others aren't even trying to project when it might happen. And in a brief aside, both of my sons now work from home. And with the one company, the owner said they have never been as productive. The company has never been as productive as when more people worked at home. And my second son is working constantly at home. He spends all day in the basement, sitting there with earphones and a telephone and a computer. And it gets to the point where he's got to stop and work out a while in order to break the monotony. So it's a different kind. Yet the list of jobs possible from home keeps expanding also. That has cushioned somewhat the huge job losses in service industries, such as restaurants and other retailers. More opportunities are needed to absorb those workers, especially in communities of color, disproportionately employed in the service industries. The concept of home as a haven of rest, shielded from the world of earning a living, is under revision. The new generation of home-based workers is investing in equipment, furnishings, and gadgets that make their home the place to work and more enjoyable. Noise-canceling headphones, for example, can help create an oasis of calm in a busy household. People who never attended a Zoom meeting before have become tech savvy much more quickly than they ever imagined possible. Combining work with home can also require devising new ways of structuring the family life, though. From how to divvy up the household chores and childcare to deciding who will get the prime spot for the morning sun or the lovely view to set up shop. In time, no doubt, many workers will drift back to rubbing elbows in offices, at least a part of the time. But the home and the work divide has been forever breached. I want to tell you about a new book. It's called Cultish: The Language of Fanaticism. It's by Amanda Montell and published by Harper Wave. Maybe you've never joined a cult, but that doesn't mean you haven't fallen sway to cultish persuasion. Amanda Montell's savvy new enlightening book demonstrates how the language that draws people into cults is now all around us, turning us into loyal disciples of influencers and brands. Not every cult has to have a spiritual component, obviously. I know more people who worship at the altar of Peloton than I do going to church, she says. And not all cultish language has a pernicious effect. But at a time when religion is fading and people look elsewhere for guidance, Montell wants us to be aware of language that functions the way cult language does, making each member of the group feel unique, but connected to others while fostering dependence on the leader, the brand, or the group. This book, Cultish, offers plenty of jaw-dropping details about life inside the cults. But Montell, who is a young feminist linguist, doesn't pass judgment on the indoctrinated. Rather, she argues that we are all vulnerable to cult methods. She says the humanity of people who do get swayed still exists. The brain of every individual is primed, she argues, to seek profound group experiences and to derive a sense of identity from shared language. The journey never ceased to be engaging. Looks like we're going to be ending today with a little bit of wit and wisdom. But before I get to that, let me just tell you what highlights you can look forward to in the next program. I'm going to be talking about the South China Sea and talking about it as a very important geopolitical problem. I'm going to be talking to you about advances in science and also who was the dinosaur destroyer. But now, a few comments of wit and wisdom where I pass along the sayings of famous people, authors. In beginning with this, James Baldwin, the author, said, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." Hannah Arendt was quoted in the Press and Journal, the United Kingdom, as saying, "Political questions are far too serious to be left to the politicians." And George Bernard Shaw, who was always good for a quote, he said, "I am afraid we must make the world honest before we can honestly say to our children that honesty is the best policy." And the philosopher Simone Weil said in the Arizona Republic, "Attention is the rarest and purest form of generosity." And we end with a quote by Lawrence Peter, the educator, who says, A censor is a man who knows more than he thinks you ought to. And with that comment, we're going to wish you a good day. We want you to be sure to come back and listen to a little of this, a little of that, because we want very much to entertain you, once in a while to amuse you. So you take care out there. Make sure you get vaccinated. It's important. And now it's about time for my friend Willie Nelson and I to go down the road looking for all of those little bits of news, those odd things that you hear on the program that you might not find in your daily newspaper or in your here on the evening TV news. So, for Dave, I wish you good health and be very good to others. They'll be good to you. Willie, I think it's time for you to take us out of here on the road again.